Support for 89.7 comes from Weiland's Market, an independent family-owned market in Clintonville since 1961, offering meats and seafood, specialty groceries, prepared foods and spirits, and more. Information at weilandsmarket.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It may seem to many like racism is on the decline, but some believe that racism has instead just taken on a different, more subtle form. The term for this is microaggression, and the term has been gaining in use, especially on college campuses. Joining us now is a New York Times reporter covering race and ethnicity, Tanzina Vega. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been writing about this, and in particular, microaggression. Can you tell us what we mean by that?
Well, it's a term, it's an academic word that's been largely around for decades, and it's been used mostly by sociologists and race theorists. It's really meant to point out the very sort of subtle language, and whether, regardless of intent, which is something we can talk about a little bit later, that people in marginalized groups, in this case we're talking about race, but we can talk about women, we can talk about people with disabilities, who feel and experience things on an everyday basis. I can give you an example, a couple of examples. When someone says, you know, you don't sound black, or you're the whitest black person I know, or where are you really from, to someone who doesn't, quote unquote, look a certain way. And those are examples of what are considered racial microaggressions.
And it matters who is saying it, doesn't it? If it's a white person saying, you're the whitest black person I know,
correct,
is different than if it's a black person saying it.
Right. And this is something that, you know, the academics that I talk to largely about this, the folks who have written about this extensively, say really, you know, microaggressions are from a white person to a non-white person, at least in the case of race. Towards women, it could be from men to women, for example. It's always the sort of majority towards the quote-unquote minority generally. Although that even that's being questioned. I mean, in the piece that I wrote at the very end of it, we have Henry Louis Gates Jr., the Harvard scholar, saying, you know, that whites should also be allowed to air their public microaggressions as well. So that's up for debate, but generally speaking, that's how it's interpreted, correct?
It seems like a form of passive aggression.
It can be. I think that, again, this is about interpretation, right? Mm-hmm. So it depends on how it's interpreted and what the intent is behind it. Some people, interestingly, in the comments that we got on the piece online, that the New York Times piece got over 600 comments, and there were lots of interesting groups of those comments. And I think some people said, you know, white people largely were saying, well, now I'm really confused. Now I just wanted to ask a question about where someone was from. I'm curious. It seems like a natural question to ask. I'm afraid now and I'm doing the wrong thing. I'm concerned that I might be offending people. What do I do now? Other people said, look, get over it. This is just, you know, the way that this is the way that we engage. These are the sort of bumpy road that we all have to deal with in terms of our daily human interactions. And other people said, no, this is a reality for me on a day-to-day basis. And as a person of color, for example, I'm tired of dealing with it, said, mm-hmm. you know, people in the comments. So I think it depends on who you are. I think it depends on what side of the comment you are and how it's taken, really. Context is very important for something like this.
We're talking about conversations about race this hour. My guest right now, Tanzina Vega, she's a national correspondent for the New York Times covering race and ethnicity. If you have a question or comment right now, we're talking about microaggression, what it is, what impact it has, what it means when it's coming from one person to another. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. Micro is a key part of this term because they're microaggressions. And so when somebody is offended by whatever is said, it can come across as overreacting and picking at stuff. And that's really troubling to people who are the targets of it.
Right. And I think that that's what one of the interesting things about this, and I think one of the reasons why it's gaining in popularity, particularly among young people, is that, you know, there was a couple of interviews that I did with students at Harvard who did this project about being Black at Harvard and what that experience was like. And one of them, you know, clearly said, you know, there are things that happen and you think, am I crazy? Did that just happen? Am I being too sensitive? And now, collectively, I think students are saying, no, actually, you're not crazy. This is happening, and it needs to stop. And so one of the academics I spoke to for my piece, Daryl Tsu, who has written the book about microaggressions and has studied this and was a key part in putting it on the map in 2007 with an academic article that he wrote, also talks about that and about how the changing demographics in the United States, the fact that there are going to be more people of color in the United States over the next couple of decades, and today we're seeing that shift as well, means that more people are looking at each other and saying, you know what, I'm not alone, it's not just me, I'm feeling it, you're feeling it, and we need to call this out.
Yeah, was that the psychology professor from Columbia University?
Yes.
He broke down microaggressions into micro-assaults, micro-insults, and micro-invalidations.
And those are micro differences. I'm not going to pretend to speak for what those are.
Mm-hmm.
I'll let him decide. You know, if you want to have him on the show, more than welcome to have him parse those apart.
Ultimately, it is in the eye of the beholder.
Correct.
And there is that issue that Lewis Gates brought up about whites and their role in the conversation, and do they even have one?
Right.
And do they feel comfortable? What from the work you did for that particular article, what do you make of that?
Well, I think there are, and interestingly enough, I think you also have people of color who have been weighing in saying, you know, I don't take this very personally. I think a lot of it is context. I think a lot of it is people who are sometimes genuinely curious and not sure probably what the language is that they should be using for their curiosity. I think there's a spectrum. And I think most people would agree that, you know, not every time someone asks you where you're from is it necessarily a bad thing. And it's particularly if that person happens to be white talking to a person of color. I think people of color, to a certain extent, feel, at least in the context of microaggressions, might feel aggrieved, if you will, if the person is singled out for being different, if you will. If they're the only person of color in a group and they're being sort of targeted and asked, you know, where are you from? No, where are you really from? And the person asking the question is not satisfied that the answer is New York. If it's a person of color answering the question, that person should, for example, I'm from New York, I should be able to say New York and that, you know, and that be the end of the conversation. And unfortunately, that doesn't always satisfy the person who's asking the question. And I think that's where it becomes tricky when people start to say, no, where are you really from? You know, where do your parents have an accent? You know, and so that's where it becomes uncomfortable. And I think for people to feel like they've been othered, that they've been sort of singled out to now be forced to talk about their ethnic and racial identity, and when they might not want to do that, when they might just want to have the conversation about whatever else is happening and not necessarily focus in on that.
You know, when you were talking about the same professor who attributed the increased use of the term microaggression to the changing demographics and in the future, particularly in which minorities are expected to outnumber whites,
mm-hmm.
I was also thinking about the changing demographics, about just the changing generation and how generationally we talk differently, and wondering if the millennial generation feels more comfortable saying, that really ticks me off, I don't like how that sounds, why did you say it that way?
I agree. I think part of what we're seeing is, first of all, the piece that inspired this microaggressions piece was a piece about whether or not young people, particularly college students, but millennials generally, were quote-unquote post-racial. And we found that, by and large, they are not. They still are dealing with race in a very interesting way. That doesn't mean that they're not open to interracial relationships or friendships or marriages. In fact, they are very open to that, but they're dealing with the sort of subtleties, if you will, the next layer of race and race relations. And like one student explained that this is racism 2.0. It's a different type of racism. The overt forms of racism that we recall from, say, you know, decades ago, 40, 50 years ago, not very socially acceptable anymore. And so now you've got young people who are saying, yeah, it's not okay to, you know, burn a cross or to do anything that would be considered, you know, support the KKK, for example, or any really, really, really extreme racism. But they still are feeling that there are these subtle slights that are a new form of that. And so they're speaking out against that.
A former colleague of mine in the newspaper business years ago wrote a column about how whites often claim to be colorblind. He is white. He admitted that he was not colorblind, and he was pretty roundly lauded for the risk he took with that column. But some people were very offended, some people who fancy themselves colorblind.
Colorblindness is somewhat a part of the post-racial discussion. And the students that I talked to, at least the students of color that I talked to at University of Michigan, where I spent a couple weeks reporting on the post-racial story, largely rejected that concept. They felt that when someone, particularly a white person, says they're colorblind, it negates who they are racially, and they did not want to be colorblind. They wanted to be acknowledged and accepted for who they were. What's interesting is I talked to another academic at Columbia who said, in fact, it wasn't fair to force whites to be colorblind. To force whites to sort of be colorblind and at the same time acknowledge racial differences is not fair. It puts them in a strange position. And so there's one thing to say, look, we want whites to see us as equal, and therefore that could it be interpreted as seeing us as being colorblind, or at the same time saying, but at the same time, I want you to acknowledge that I am, you know, this particular race and respect that, or this particular ethnicity. And it's almost like you can't have it both ways. And I think where I don't have the answer, I think these are the things that are being worked out in the race conversation as a whole.
Tanzina Vega, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Good to be on.
Tanzina Vega, she's national correspondent for the New York Times covering race and ethnicity. Coming up, we're going to hear from an organization called Race Forward. They have a new study out about these same topics, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Many of the conversations we have about race are sparked and influenced by what we read, see, and hear through mainstream media. Some believe that the media fails to break down stereotypes and address issues of race fairly and adequately. Race Forward, the Center for Racial Justice Innovation in New York, has produced a new report intended to reshape and reform how we talk about race and racism in the United States. Joining us now by phone from New York is the executive director of Race Forward, Rinku Sen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Anne.
Rinku, what did the report look at?
Well, what we did was look at more than 1,200 pieces of coverage, mostly newspaper coverage, of key debates that took place in our country over the last couple of years, the Paula Deen incident, the Trayvon Martin killing, those kinds of things. And what we found was that the coverage was had a number of problems. One big one was that it individualized the entire discussion, and it reinforced the notion that racism and racial bias are always individual and overt and intentional. And the debates really focused on things like individual attitudes and actions, racial slurs. And the question that was being asked was, is this person racist? Is Paula Deen racist? Is George Zimmerman racist? And what gets hidden in coverage like that is the fact that racism and racial bias have actually developed new mechanisms and new forms, which are often actually systemic, that is, they're built into the rules of our institutions and society, and often unconscious and actually hidden. So if our only standard for racial progress is that people have changed their attitudes and act better, we're not actually going to be able to address the causes of racial inequity. So our report uncovers seven harmful practices in the mainstream media, including individualizing racism, and proposes that we could have a richer, fuller, more productive debate if we build up our muscle for talking about systemic racial bias.
How would we take, for instance, a story like Paula Deen, of course, the cookbook author and television cooking personality, and her racist comments, how do you take that and build it into something larger and more in depth in terms of a conversation? Or is the point to dispense with those individualized examples altogether?
Well, it doesn't make sense to dispense with the examples altogether because they are actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that people live race is through these interpersonal interactions quite often. So, but in that example, which is a good one, we could have taken a much deeper look at the restaurant industry. Mm-hmm. We could have looked at that industry in the South in particular. We did a report a couple of years ago that actually breaks down the race and gender, the demographics of food industries and who is working in what kinds of jobs and how they are compensated for those jobs, what the career ladders are like in those jobs. But none of that kind of big picture look at how segregation happens in an industry and what that segregation is based on and how it is sustained appeared, for example, in the coverage of the Paula Deen story.
Well, it sure would have been a lot more interesting.
I think so, myself. Yeah.
One of your key findings was that mainstream media's racism content is not systemically aware. What do you mean by systemically aware? That if they're not thinking about it as they do it? In other words, nobody really thought about how we were covering Paula Deen, but just did it?
Yeah, I think that the problem is that the creators of mainstream media, reporters, editors, producers, also have this definition of racism that is individual, overt, and intentional. And so it doesn't, I think two things happen. One is that they themselves don't have a good understanding that the rules in institutions, both written and unwritten, you know, I don't think most industries, as a matter of written policy, segregate their workers, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a number of media makers don't actually understand that those rules, even if they appear to be race neutral, have racialized impacts, that they have different impacts on people of color than they do on white folks. So one problem is a general lack of awareness. But I think another problem is that media producers have a difficult time figuring out how to make those rules into a story that seems emotionally resonant and is a good story, where things happen in the story. Our sort of approach to policies and rules in general is quite often to just let our eyes glaze over, and it just all seems very dull. So I think figuring out, as a matter of creativity and good reporting, how to insert that kind of reporting into the things that actually happen. Someone gets killed, someone gets exploited at work. That's the job that is in front of media producers who want to help really make our discourse more productive and deeper.
Part of that's changing who your touchstones are in journalism. Who do you go to repeatedly for insight on the same things? Do you always go to the proverbial barbershop? Are there other touchstones in the community you could be reaching out to? And that's not necessarily a bad touchstone, by the way, but it's been, what's the word, not trivialized, but it's almost cliche. And there are certainly...
Yeah, it's a little overdone, the barbershop sources. You know, community organizations are a wonderful source, too, that I don't think that I think reporters could develop much stronger relationships with, sourcing relationships with. Our report includes five interventions that we thought helped to change the debate on these matters. And a couple of those interventions are really artistic. We looked at the Migration is Beautiful campaign, which worked off of the theme of butterflies and how they don't know borders, but really use that butterfly image as a way to get people talking about immigration policy and where that policy comes from and what impact that policy has on actual human beings and families. That's a great example. And the artists who created that meme are in very close touch with the immigrant rights movement. Another great example, I think, out of entertainment was Fruitvale Station, which actually both of these examples moved forward one of our recommendations, which was in our coverage and in our production of even of entertainment, that we focus on and elevate the humanity and leadership of people of color. So what was so great about Fruitvale Station was not so much that it took apart the institutional workings of the public transit policing system in the Bay Area, but that it really centered on Oscar Grant and who he was. Centered on Oscar Grant and elevated his humanity so that when we have a debate about policing, then we can have it with a clear understanding of who is affected and how.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Rinku Sen. She's publisher of Color Lines and executive director of Race Forward. We're talking about a study that Race Forward has done on media coverage about it's intended, the report actually is intended to reshape and reform how we talk about race and racism in the United States. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We've talked about individualizing racism. It was one of the seven practices associated with perpetuating the myth of the post-racist era, that racism is rare and isolated. Another one was falsely equating incomparable acts. Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah. You know, one example from my life is a while back, I was getting a ride from a car rental outfit from whom I had rented a car. They had picked me up at my house in Queens, New York, and were driving me to the rental station. And the driver was a youngish white man in his 30s, very likely. He asked me what I did for work. I said, I do racial justice work. I run this, you know, racial justice organization. And he said, yeah, I experience racism a lot. You know, let me tell you how I experience racism. This black person came into the rental office and wanted to rent a car and didn't have the proper ID required. I can't remember if it was a credit card that the person didn't have or the right kind of driver's license. And when I wouldn't rent him the car, he got really angry with me and said something about my whiteness and, you know, was really wrong. So that's a really good example, I think, of a white person getting his feelings hurt or having a difficult interaction and calling that racism and equating it with the kind of racial bias that actually costs people their jobs and access to really good health care and access to an adequate education. So it's taking the making the acts the same without taking any kind of power dynamics into account or the likely impact of a particular incident, not just on that particular person at that moment, but on their entire lives and quite often on their families, too.
There's been conversations lately about the use of the word slavery or one of its, you know, versions of slavery. I was slaved over my taxes and she drove me like a slave. You know, we use it. It's very, very common, but it's starting to occur to people that that's kind of a stupid thing to say, that it's
right.
not really accurate. It's not even close and it's not funny.
Yeah. You know, I some time ago, I became aware of how often I say that I am starving.
Mm-hmm.
And when that really means I haven't eaten in 6 hours or 7 hours and or sometimes longer, but
or sometimes less in my
starving,
yeah.
I'm hungry, my blood sugar is low. But starving is an entirely different matter, and I took it out of my vocabulary. I made a real effort not to use it in that context because we do need to give important matters the weight that they deserve, and if the language of oppression and deep loss becomes attached to temporary things and trivial things, that is in fact a problem.
When you told the story about the driver and his falsely equating that incomparable act with what your work is, that was a case of, if someone sympathized with him, that would be a case of prioritizing intent over impact. In other words, if you had brought it to his attention about, well, you know, it's really not the same thing I do, it's really not what we're talking about, he would say, well, I didn't mean it that way. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to offend you or falsely equate incomparable acts. And
mm-hmm.
you're saying that's another one of the practices associated with perpetuating the myth of the post-racist era. I didn't mean it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really important because the historic definitions of racism have really included intention. You know, you had to have racist intention in order to count as a racist.
Mm-hmm.
And there was plenty of racist intention to be seen, right? This is the pre-Civil Rights Act era. That was very obvious and there. But the problem with focusing entirely on intention now, making the question, who's the racist, and making the action, routing out the racist, the problem with that is that it starts to give the impression, because those kinds of incidents are so rare today, that racism is simply a personal failing and that it can be, racial inequity can be reversed or racial gaps can be closed solely through personal attitude change and personal action alone. So that is a highly limited understanding of what we need to do to be a racially equitable society. And even worse, it gives the impression that we that racism is actually no longer a problem at all. We ran a campaign for some years called Drop the I Word, where we, this is one of the case studies that's in the report, we urged people to stop using the language of illegality as attached to immigrants, and we lobbied the Associated Press to take the phrase illegal immigrant out of their style guide, which they did last year in April, just about exactly a year ago. And very often when I talk to reporters about that campaign and to editors, they said, well, when we use illegal, we don't mean it as a slur. We're not trying to say that, you know, we don't like brown-skinned immigrants. And yet that was, in fact, the effect of the word on the immigration debate and on immigrants themselves, as well as on any number of people of color who could be mistaken for immigrants. So it is, it does matter to me that people don't intend to have that effect, and I accept that lack of intention on good faith, and then I want to move very quickly to a discussion about its impact, because that's the discussion that's going to lead us, point the way toward which rules we need to change. And that discussion of the rules is going to give us a context for changing our individual behavior.
Intentionality is a really important function of all of this. In other words, we should be intentional about how we talk. We should think about how we talk and what it says and how it's going to make somebody feel. It's almost as simple as that.
Yeah, I think the
which is not easy, but it's a simple concept, but it's not necessarily easy to execute.
That's right. But the problem with it is that it stands as a counter to the notion of color blindness, which says that essentially you should have no intention whatsoever on race ever. You know, it's a blindness. It's a negative that we want to achieve through color blindness. And what we know from a great deal of research on the brain from the last 15, 20 years is that most bias is actually unconscious. And there are examples of the opposite, to be sure. But the majority of people do not hold conscious bias. If you ask them, do you dislike people of color, they will say, of course not. And yet, these biases are so deeply embedded into our brains that the only way we can actually address them make sure that our institutions are enabling positive activity, equitable activity, non-discriminatory activity, is to build a really conscious intention around it. And we hope that the kinds of recommendations we make in our report and the kinds of work we do at the organization help people build that muscle and that willingness and the skill that they need to enter those debates wherever they are.
Rinku Sen, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. If I could just encourage people to take a look at our website, raceforward.org. And one of our bigger programs is a biennial conference called Facing Race, which will be happening in Dallas this year, and where much of the most innovative work in this area will be presented. So really hope to see a lot of your listeners there. The Kerwin Institute, which is local to Columbus, is collaborating with us on the research and policy track of that conference. So lots of local and national resources at Facing Race for your listeners.
That's Rinku Sen. She is publisher of Color Lines and executive director of Race Forward, the Center for Racial Justice Innovation. They've produced a new report intended to reshape and reform how we talk about race and racism in the United States. We'll have a link to their website and that report on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we're going to talk about the intersection of this conversation and the arts. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We've been talking about how to talk about race, harmful practices used by mainstream media and everyday people in conversation, often unconsciously, usually unconsciously. One of the lessons of a new report by Race Forward, the Center for Racial Justice Innovation, is to use cultural and artistic media to reveal and explore systemic racism. A new production from Available Light Theater attempts to do that with the play, and this is a long one. It's a mouthful. We are proud to present a presentation about the Herero of Namibia, formerly known as Southwest Africa, from the German Sudwest Africa between the years 1884 and 1915. The show opens tonight. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now to discuss the show is Available Light Theater Artistic Director and Director of this production, Matt Slabaugh. Welcome back.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Also joining us is one of the actors in We Are Proud to Present, David Glover. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
This is a play within a play, a theater company working on a story about genocide of a people in German colonial Southwest Africa. Mm-hmm. The conflict is over whether this is a story about the whites or the blacks. Right, Matt?
Yes, in large part. It starts out as a question of representation, right? And that classic conflict between the facts and the truth, and that they're trying to tell a story about a group of people about whom they don't have much information. They have a lot of information about the Germans who were there, mm-hmm. Who left letters and personal records behind. But of course, in that information, they didn't write down a lot about all the thousands and thousands of people that they were killing.
And of course, David Glover, the people were gone, and there was no one left. And at a certain point in the story, someone says, well, they didn't write anything down.
Well, yeah, they didn't have the opportunity to.
And then it becomes the job of the black performers mm-hmm. to try to make sense of that for the white performers and why that does not negate.
Correct. And to keep that voice alive and to give that opportunity for that voice to be spoken that, you know, it's not necessarily tangibly written, but we know was there because there's a history of these people.
Certainly not a new conversation.
Mm-mm. No.
Not at all.
But set in another place.
Yes.
How does that help have the conversation, David? What did you make of that?
It gives credence, I guess, and invites more people to talk about it. Necessarily, we sometimes feel safe to talk about things that don't directly affect us, say, as Americans, to say this happened in America, but to give us a place that gives a little distance to say that it happened in a different place, and that invites people to the table to talk about something that they're not immediately connected to, but can be connected to, because there's similar storylines and a similar conversation can happen.
Yeah, there's a real parallel there. The play begins with a lot of great dry humor.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Very, very funny. How does that function in the conflict to come, Matt Slabaugh?
Well, the playwright is really smart, again, in placing these difficult conversations in a context that's almost a little bit silly and creating characters, these actors who are really sincere and have really great intentions but are not necessarily really that good at their job. So she puts some very human characters that you can identify with and keeps the conversation from being too didactic. But of course, through the humor, you become really attached to these people and you really get involved in their process. And then, as you experienced last night, at a certain point, the play starts to turn, and you're already wrapped up in it before you know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
In the play, the white actors appear to learn horrible things about what they could be, like mm-hmm. the characters in the
yes.
play.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about how to have a conversation about racism. It's about how we think of ourselves. Now, we don't have the white actors here to talk about what that felt like, but there was also the sensation of some of the black actors standing by and watching.
Correct.
A form of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like, and what can you tell us about how you talked this through with your fellow actors on that show?
Well, it's the thing of every day you are in placed in a situation to where something may be off-colorly said in a conversation. And then for me, as a black actor and an African-American, there are times where you question whether or not you should address that. If, say, I work in a predominantly white environment where I'm one of three people of color, where sometimes off-color comments are said, but not necessarily in a harmful way. They're just said out of something that may or may not be known to the individual. And you almost take it as a point to where I think I'm supposed to say something or think I'm supposed to address that, but I don't want to come off as the voice of all African-Americans just because I happen to be the only one in the room. And so part of that is in watching my character watch some of the horrible things that go down in the show. You think about what is your role to address that, to step in, or to stop that even if you can. And then how does that make you feel when you don't? And how does that make you, how are you perceived by others when you don't step in and comment on it?
We were talking about individualizing racism earlier and that idea of that. It's like, well, I don't really, we shouldn't really complain about it because it's just me. And really, we have a black president now and, you know, things are so much better than they used to be. Is David, is that something that you feel? Does that resonate with you when we talk about it in those terms?
Most definitely. There's always someone who says, well, we have a black president, so things are much better. I mean, yes, things are better, but racism still exists and it's still a conversation that needs to be had and continued to be have about how we address those topics amongst each other. And so it's not something that we can just all of a sudden say, oh, well, you know, there's a black president, so we're all good, right? It's not. And it's something that we're still working toward and those are helping, but we can still continue to have those conversations and continue to make strides in that talk.
We had a lot of conversations when we started working on the play about these topics at an individual level, how we felt individually about things in our community and in the larger nation and how that relates to the play. Somewhat trying to come to consensus as a group, but at least trying to get the issues out and in the room so that we could talk about those things, knowing that we were going to have to talk about lots of difficult things as the process went on. And that was very helpful. It was very helpful, I think, in a way of giving all the actors permission to separate themselves from their roles, acknowledging that they all had a role to play in the production, one that might not be a person that they want to play. Certainly the two white gentlemen who are in the play, when the play ends, they feel like bad people. They don't want to look the audience in the eye. They can't help, you know, as creative artists, but absorb some of that stuff.
But then they also sort of come together to pat, you know, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's okay. Don't feel badly.
There's that very human response of them trying to get out of that uncomfortable moment.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. It was interesting. We have an email from Dennis. I wonder what you guys think about this. He says, as a white person, all your program today does is convince me even more to never bring up anything remotely racial in daily life. The idea that everything is context, in quotation marks, does nothing but make me paranoid about this topic, and so I simply shut up. In my opinion, this does nothing to help resolve whatever issues we need to address. I would say, you know, when we were talking earlier with my last guest about how the arts and creativity can sometimes help us bridge those gaps, Matt Slabaugh, I mean, was this kind of a struggle that Dennis is having part of why you picked this play?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Available Light, we're all about trying to find plays that create really potent and important conversations. And in reading the play and in working on the play, part of what we realized was what a slippery slope it is, how close we are sometimes to some really bad behavior. But again, the play allows us to look at these things and be in a room and be in a safe place to have the conversation, which of course is the really, really difficult thing in everyday life. You don't always have a play or a TV show that you can show to your friends to create conversation and open up a dialogue. But the effort that hopefully people will take away having seen the play, they'll take away the idea that it's important to make an effort, even when it's hard. These conversations have got to be had because, as David said, this stuff isn't going away. The roots are deep, so, so deep. And as one of your earlier guests mentioned, it's one thing to talk about the most overt and most outward behavior and the behavior that you can address specifically, but that doesn't necessarily change the mindset or change what's deep inside people. And it takes a greater effort and some more interpretive efforts, I personally think, to address those more deeply set issues.
Email from Miles writes, I know this level of serious discussion on systematic and unconscious racism can be tedious for my white friends, But why it matters to me is that I don't get an off switch for this situation. It's easy for them to say, oh, I don't want to talk about that, and it's done for them. But I have to walk around the world with my skin all day, every day. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if I'm wearing a tie, speaking the King's English, or saving babies from rabid tigers. The color of my skin precedes me and makes things hard, and I can't turn it off. Mm-hmm. Wow. That's tedious to listen to for Miles' white friends, but I think it goes way beyond tedium when he puts it in those terms for himself.
Well, absolutely. Miles's friends need to recognize the way white privilege interacts with their everyday lives.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like that's a really great demonstration and explanation of what it's like to be different.
Yeah. David Glover, why? I mean, you're always probably looking for a play to be in. You're an actor, right?
You're a wonderful actor.
But very, yes. And you. It was wonderful. But was there something particular about this one? When you heard about it, was like, yeah, I got to be in that play.
I saw this on the season this year and then had the opportunity to read it. And upon reading it, found myself doing what most people, I hope, will see it. I mean, I was drawn in by the writing and then punched in the gut when it turns on you. And I was drawn and wanted to be so much a part of this because as myself, as many people are, I'm uncomfortable. I myself am uncomfortable talking about the topic of race sometimes, even as an African-American man, because sometimes I don't know how to approach it. And I think that's important to people understand that it's not a thing of that, you know, I want to run into and always talk about. I shy away from it personally. And so I felt that this show and the writing in the show and the topics in this show, for me, I would be forced to deal with bring forward in my life, and would encourage me to move after being in it, to be brave enough to start those conversations if necessarily needed, and to be a part of those conversations, and to be in a room. Matt said it's to be in that room, it's given you a safe place with people whom I trust and people whom I love to start those conversations. And it's a nice starting place for me. And now I've been able to translate that into other parts of my lives, being able to have those conversations with friends whom for years, you know, you've kind of skirted the topic and I've always shied away from. So it's made me a braver individual in talking about these things and realizing the need to talk about. It's just a piece that I connected to and wanted to be a part of because I knew it would be life-changing.
You know, the issue of heritage comes up in the play. Mm-hmm. She's the main character, but the woman...
Her character name is Black Woman. She's played Chanel Marie, yes.
Black Woman, Chanel, her character, it focuses very much on a photograph of a woman from the Herero.
Mm-hmm.
And she's never met her grandmother, but she identifies with the picture of this woman and says she could have been my grandmother. The idea of heritage for the Hereros is a problem and problematic going forward because not enough of them survived to have much of a documentation of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing can be said to a large extent about the slave history in the United States and what it did to the heritage of millions of people mm-hmm. going forward. They don't have those pictures dating back to, you know, the 1800s kind of a thing. They don't have the family trees and that sort of a thing. That really moved me, the idea that we take, and maybe it's that white privilege thing. It's not that I'm rich. It's just that I know we can date back to the 1500s where my family came from and how important that is, but we take it for granted.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that speech is really, really beautiful. And it's one of the things the play does so well is to point to something that might have been just in the back of your brain, but you've never quite contemplated it. But when it's expressed so beautifully, you have that full realization. Yeah, it's really, really quite stunning. I had the same experience first time hearing that and reading that.
It reminds me of that scene in Antoine Fisher, the movie, at the very end where he walks in. He's been looking for his family, and what he has is something much greater than he thought he had, which is this huge extended family with very old people, not just a mom and a dad or something like that. There's much more to it than that. David Glover, I want to thank you for joining us today. And you're the other Black man in the play. He'll be the other Black man in the play. You should see it. It's called proud to present a presentation about the Herero of Namibia, formerly known as Southwest Africa, from the German Sudwest Africa between the years 1884 to 1915. The show is being performed March 27th through April 12th at Rife Studio 2. For more information, you can go to a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And as always, Matt Slabaugh, Artistic Director of Available Light Theater, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Wonderful to be here.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Julia Hyder, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOS News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.